I just wanted to introduce Tony Ferraro and David Stone, who are going to be our guests today. We're going to be speaking about applications of social networking technology to medical treatment, which is quite an interesting topic, and I'm really excited to hear more about what they say. I know we have a few people here from the medical community who are interested in sort of medical uses for social technology, and I think that it would be great to hear about anybody who's working in the medical sector that has a specific interest in this. So we're just going to go around, do some introductions. If you could say your name and where you're from, that would be great. And just to let you know, we're being webcasted right now, and this presentation will be put on our blog as a podcast, as a video, too, as well. And so feel free to check that out afterwards, and welcome. So if you want to get started on Amar, you can start here.
I'm Mark Dion. I work with Brigham Women's Department of Social Medicine and also Partners in Health. We're doing web access and web training for around the world.
Nick Bramble, I'm a clinical student here.
Christina Olson, I'm a fellow. I work on Stop Ever.
Josh Goldstein, Berkman intern as of yesterday.
I'm Evan Crone. I work for the OpenNet Initiative that studies internet filtration worldwide.
Studies what?
Internet filtration worldwide.
Anna, a Harvard Law School student.
I'm Sally Wafferman. I coordinate some research projects here at Berkman.
I'm Matt Lovell. I help run the clinical program here.
I'm Sheila Gogate. I'm a clinical student.
I'm Nick Payne, the director of training for Day Pairing.
Gene Koo, fellow here.
John Clippinger, fellow, open identity.
Adrian Gropper, I'm involved in medical records. I'm a physician medical device developer.
Here. I'm Ben Weeks. I'm a junior programmer for Stop Adware here at the center.
I'm Tim Hong. I go to the college.
Pat McKiernan, I am the communications coordinator from Berkman Center.
Yeah, I'm just going to work on Berkman's control meters.
On which one?
I'm Nick Angler, I'm a student at law school. Eric Mullen, doing some work for the Berkman Center, but I'm in, like, associated with the medical school.
Kenu Kumari, intern from GearUp.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for coming. I'm David Stone, and I'm a psychologist in private practice in Atlanta. But back in 2004, I came to Harvard as a visiting fellow in computer science and started coming to these meetings while I was doing that. I also have a company that I started about 12 years ago that uses technology, or helps companies, helps big companies use technology in a variety of ways to improve their employees' performance. I've also been head of the Harvard Industrial, or the industry liaison for the Harvard Industrial Partnership for the Division of Engineering and Applied Sciences here. But more recently, I've transitioned to MIT. I actually have I'm on the research staff at MIT and work on projects having to do with handheld wireless devices and things like that. Well, actually, what brings us here today sort of is a blending of a variety of different things, common interests that Tony and I have. As a psychologist, of course, I have to be continually educating myself, and so I come up here to the medical school. I've probably taken all the courses in psychology and behavioral medicine you can take at Harvard Medical School. And in my practice in Atlanta, I wound up getting connected with a center for torture and trauma survivors. It's not a very attractive subject for a lot of people, you know, but it sort of hooked me. And when I first told people I was going to be going to the Center for Torture and Trauma Survivors, they said, well, you know, those people are just going to be coming to you with stories they've heard from other people, and they're just going to come here and try to get asylum and all of that. They probably didn't have any of those experiences themselves. Of course, the first person that doesn't sound too good, does it? But that's what I heard. So the first person I met had been in prison in Iraq for a year and had been tortured every day and had 20 obviously serious things wrong with him. So that idea kind of went away quickly. And I've learned a lot through that experience about how to help people who have experienced that kind of trauma and other kinds of trauma. And one of the things I've done fairly recently is meet with Dr. Richard Mollica here at Harvard, who is in charge of the Harvard Trauma Center. And this is a really good book. You know, most of the things you might hear about well, anything having to do with torture and trauma and so forth is pretty tough stuff. The stories themselves can traumatize you. But I suggest that you might want to consider reading this book. It's called Healing Invisible Wounds. It's by Richard Malacca, and it's come out fairly recently. It won't traumatize you, but it'll help you understand the needs of that kind of population. And so that's worth knowing about. Well, the purpose of our visit here is to share some thoughts we have about the application of technology to the delivery of medical services for the victims of trauma, including torture. And it's pretty straightforward stuff. Very simple idea. So let me put some things on the screen and we'll talk about them. Now, this is a place where you hear all kinds of good things about technology all the time. You've seen great examples. Charlie Nesson's course in the law school done through Second Life. How many of you are familiar with that course? You've seen that, right? So that's a powerful example of the use of Second Life for instruction. Ron Diebert's software, Siphon, you know about that, right? He's been here recently. He's probably going to come back again, right? I mean, so I've hooked up with him as well. And then Tony. We'll talk about Tony shortly. But the basic concept is fairly straightforward. The idea is to think about how we can improve trauma treatment globally. This involves implementing a continuous improvement model for the delivery of medical services, providing online community support for survivors, providing communication and support for those left behind in closed countries. So if you know something about Siphon, you realize that that's really what applies to that last example, because Siphon is software that lets people in refugee communities communicate through, into closed countries to people who have been left behind. So if you want to maintain those connections, that would do that well. Going forward, we want to support the sharing and use of best practices through social networking technology for medical staff, refugee populations, and for those left behind. Now, recently I had the opportunity to serve on a review committee that took a look at the Center for Torture and Trauma Survivors as a practice, which was a pretty cool thing to do because it was a very rigorous assessment methodology. We were trained for several days on how to do it. We met with the staff of that center. There are 20 such centers around the United States funded by the Congress to help people who've come here legally from other countries because they've been tortured, and to understand what the outcomes of the treatment methods were. It's very rigorous and a good model, although there are many others that could have been used. And so one of the ideas that occurred to me was, well, gosh, if we can build electronic performance support systems over at MIT to support the work of great corporations, global corporations, what could we do in terms of applying technology to ensure that these continuous improvement models and assessment models for the practice of medicine could be supported through technology to ensure better performance by staff, measurement of outcomes, so that instead of sort of being a wishy-washy, well, what did we really do here, kind of thing you might experience in a psychology or psychiatric practice, you have some real measurable, tangible outcomes. You know, and before you can go to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and say, give us $5 billion because we want to improve the treatment of trauma victims globally, they're going to want to see, well, what's your methodology? What are the results? What's the data tell you, right? Well, the methodologies are really good. There's some good treatment models, good assessment models, continuous improvement models, but they have not been instantiated in software systems that support their continuance through changes in personnel and everything else. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Again, it's a very simple concept. You know, clinical services, add some technology, improve treatment, and scale it globally. Do it well in a few places, document it, and then go after the funding necessary to deal with the problem at a larger level. So today, there's the Siphon component dealing with refugees and the left behind community. There's 360 hubs, there are affinity hubs, which we'll be hearing about from Tony, and how we can support the use of best practices and train clinical staff and support them in their measurement of outcomes and building a global clinical community of people who work with trauma victims and survivors. And then Second Life. I have a different approach to Second Life. You've seen it, you know about it. I've taken a fairly different approach to Second Life. And we're going to go into Second Life shortly, maybe looking at it from a different way of thinking. The idea there is essentially to use Second Life instead of just as an instructional methodology, but to use it in the context of an online real community, people who can support each other.
Can I ask a quick question?
Of course.
How are you defining trauma in this space for those lawyers and other non-medical professionals?
I'm glad you asked that question. I probably should go. Let's just we'll blow through that, and we'll go right to the web here, and I'll give you a link to something that ought to tell us at least how we're defining some of that. Let's see. We're dealing with. A second here. Okay, well, we can talk about what torture means anyway. And so I'm in the maybe Tony can talk about what trauma means, but I'm going to focus on torture. Means an act committed by a person acting under the color of law, specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering, other than pain or suffering incidental to lawful sanctions, upon another person within his custody or physical control. So that's how we decide if you're eligible for treatment at the CTTS in Atlanta. So right now, let's go into Second Life. And this is, we'll get back in here in a second here. I'm going to have to log out and log back in. What's going to happen here is we're going to kind of run a risk. This is not a canned presentation. You know, and the Los Angeles Times had a article a couple of weeks ago about the use of Second Life by churches who were establishing communities, and you know, they the first line in the article said the naked lady didn't show up for the Easter service. There are like 4.5 million people in Second Life, and I don't know what's going to happen. There's somebody waiting in Second Life for me to talk to them, but there are all kinds of other people who could theoretically show up uninvited. So be warned. But so what we're going to do is we're going to visit with somebody who is actually physically disabled and who was elderly, shall we say, and lives in England, and her avatar is right there, and we've become friends over a period of time. I've actually functioned more like an anthropologist than a psychologist, probably in this setting, because I've joined an existing community. So this is on a little island in Second Life, and everything in the immediate vicinity was put together by Lois Allen. So she's going to give us a little tour. But it's not so much the tour that's of interest in terms of what I'm going to be talking about.
Much younger, David, than you appear.
And my avatar looks better than I do, too, so what can I do? One of the things I've noticed, of course, is there's body language. These, you know, avatars move on their own. It turns out that Lois knows how to edit her body language, and so she does, and it has an effect. Even though she's got multiple sclerosis. Okay. She knows a lot about how things work. Now, there are people, there are software engineers who know how things work here, but she's a real user of this environment. She spends most of her time here. So she's a genealogist. I should tell you, and I don't know if this will bother anybody, but this is a Mormon community. I'm not a Mormon, but I decided I wanted to try to find a place where there was an existing community and there was a fairly supportive social structure, and just get some ideas myself about what it would be like to live in that kind of community, whether it would be possible to have support for people who had suffered trauma and other kinds of, I don't know about torture, but I haven't had any examples of that yet. But I've certainly spent some time, even though I'm I'm not actually practicing in this world. I've actually spent some time doing grief counseling and so forth. For the real people these avatars represent. So these are databases. You know, the Mormons keep detailed genealogical records, and I'm not sure. Okay. Well, you can all read that, right? I don't have to read it to you. Should I read it? Okay. This is my center. It's interactive, and people come to do research. Okay. my answers are short. Yeah, so should I click on the spinning globe? Let's see.
It's dollars.
Okay, well, the dollar sign shows up, but et cetera, et cetera. That's your welcome message, Family History Center and Remembrance Garden. And you can do it yourself. I actually have used it myself, but I don't think we're going to take time to go into my genealogy here. But I will tell you this. In 1635, my family owned all this land. Okay, now, where'd she go? She ran off. Yeah, she has her own elephant there, you see? It's just resting, trust me. It's just resting.
It's just sleeping. That's what they always say.
I found many people are grieving, so I offer lanterns to people who remember their loved ones. Okay. Thanks for showing us. Can we see the treehouse?
You've been here before.
I've been here before lots of times, that's right.
Does she sell access to these things?
No, she's the teleport for the island is right on her property, so she gets a lot of people coming through.
What's the name of the island?
It is Adam and Amund Island, or something like that. We're going to fly.
Adam
on
the
I can't pronounce it correctly, yeah, I'm sure. So she has a treehouse here, which is kind of cool. You'll notice that I'm pretty inept, actually, at walking through doors and flying around. She doesn't have those problems. I'm still pretty much a novice at all this. I went up in the hot tub. Well, that's all right. Nice view of the ocean. I think she's on a different level. Let's see.
Is there a follow command in the Second Life?
I can just hit the teleport button.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, she wants me. She knows I'm clumsy, so she offered to teleport me. Okay. Hang on. Don't worry. We'll get there. No! I told you, didn't I?
Oh, boy.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, here we are. We'll try again. All right. So you can sit in these little... I haven't been invited to, but I'm just sit there. Sit and meditate. Okay.
Can't fall if you're sitting there.
That's what I'm going to do. Sit down. Nice view. Okay. Let's see. How long did it take you? All right, but my point here is not, she's going to show us, you know, probably take a few minutes more, and we'll look at various things she's built and so forth, but essentially, oh look, the windows are closed, and now you see the different scene. But this place is full of some very interesting simulations. You know, in the world of building games for PCs, you know, it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars and takes months or even years to build games. But in the world of Second Life, it turns out that they're all... I mean, I've already put a nuclear reactor in my inventory. I've got boats and airplanes and cars that perform relatively realistically in this environment without a huge investment in terms of development time. So, Professor Nessen, how are you today?
Wonderful.
Yeah. So in terms of... I mean, for example, one of the criticisms I've received from people who know me is... Well, David, how come you spend so much time in Second Life? You know, you've got a business to run, you've got a psychology practice, and I told them, already my corporate clients have more than compensated me for that time, because the things I've learned about how to build things and do things that are not normally easy have been very useful.
And Are you going to tie this back to trauma and torture?
I am indeed.
Yeah.
I am indeed. Let's do that now.
We like Second Life.
Okay. Well, here's the. I'm going to say goodbye, and we'll leave that right now. Okay. The purpose of doing that was to show you that effectively, this is an example of a single community that I've visited to spend some time in, and that I've actually formed real relationships with real people in this community. And I've spent time working as a psychologist in this environment. And I've become convinced that, in fact, that it wouldn't be a bad thing for people who have experienced trauma of various kinds to be in such a community if it were designed intentionally to create conditions that were favorable for their recovery and their improvement. And this is a very controversial idea. I have a professor at the Divinity School I've been working with for a couple of years, and of course her first comment is, I hate the internet. And the second comment is, well, what about the conflict between your identity as an individual and your avatar? What kind of confusion is there? Is there confusion? I have to be honest and say that I've met people in this world in the last 60 days for whom there has been confusion. Because it turns out that many people who spend significant time in Second Life form emotional attachments with each other, and it surprises you because you think it's just a game or it's just an artificial world, but it's not. It's real in a lot of ways. So I think the correct way to say this is, I've been interested in exploring the use of Second Life as a tool in a clinical practice. I've done some exploration of that in terms of doing some counseling in it, and I have the belief that if you constructed a community intentionally to support victims of trauma, that it could be a valuable tool in the treatment of trauma. Can't prove it yet, and some people would disagree with those thoughts, but that's what I think. So again, there are three technology components to this model that I've got for supporting the improvement of the treatment of people with torture and trauma wounds. One is the Siphon tool to build community for people who are still behind the in those countries that are closed, and the second is potentially Second Life for the victims of trauma if the community they're in is therapeutic, and the third, well, Tony is the president of 360 Hubs, and he has a product that's called Affinity Hubs, and he'll tell you about that. Question.
Are you done with this?
I think this is wonderful and nice, but for a certain subset of individuals. I'll give you an example. Yesterday I had the pleasure of speaking to a student from Baghdad, Iraq, who's at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. She's in political science, and I asked her about internet and access, and she said they have a problem. They wouldn't be able to download the software for this. They barely have access, and there's obviously a need to communicate with some of the refugees in Amman, Jordan, and relatives in Syria, people in the diaspora, people in the UK, and people in the U.S., well, the three or four people in the U.S. that have been allowed to come here. And obviously dealing with the trauma, there's not an opportunity to have even access to even get into the first life, let alone the second life.
I don't think you're going to be treating people that are living in Iraq for trauma using these tools.
Yeah.
What Siphon does, though, is allow some communication to occur between the population of people who've left and the population who've remained behind in a relatively secure way based on human social networks, trusted people you can share your software with or the log into your home PC with. And that's that function that's supported by Siphon. And Professor Diebert and others have explained that much better than I could.
Can you say a little bit more about what you envision a therapeutic community in Second Life having,
well,
looking like? What would it be?
What would it look like?
Well, maybe not so much what it looks like, but what is it that people do? Are there therapists there?
The first thing is, I've sort of done some naturalistic observation of what Second Life, what's going on there. There are real communities there. There are people practicing psychiatry and psychology. There are centers for various kinds of therapy, psychotherapy and so forth in that world now. And there are communities that have certain standards. I mean, whether you like the Mormons or don't like the Mormons and the way they live or not, they seem to have a strong, strongly integrated community that's very supportive. And I've observed them help each other and help other people through difficult situations. And this is real people with real problems and all of that. I've been part of that. So I believe that it's possible to intentionally construct a therapeutic community in Second Life that would give access to people who are not physically able to be in communication with other people as well as others. I mean, these are beliefs. I haven't proven this. I haven't done the research. But my first impression is, based on, you know, basically 2 or 3 months of fairly intensive time there, that in addition to the technological benefits that come from using leveraging that environment, that there are some potentially valuable psychological treatment options that come from using this as an adjunct, perhaps, to other kinds of treatment.
Do you see therapists as being identified as therapists in there, and special resources?
Or? There are therapists in this environment that are identified that way, that are practicing. I, you know, this is the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School. Probably somebody here knows, you know, whose license jurisdiction I would fall under if I was practicing. I don't know. I'm licensed in New York State and in Georgia, but if I'm in Second Life and I hang out a shingle and charge fees, and there are people doing that, and whether my malpractice insurance would cover me there, I don't know. I don't know. So I'm not charging money, and I'm not functioning in that way formally. But as a member of a community, I am in fact providing significant amounts of counseling and support to people. And other people without credentials are doing it and doing a reasonably good job just because they're decent human beings. But I think that's a way, it's another set of potential tools to help improve the lives of people who might be restricted from being able to be part of this. I mean, this woman you just saw, as I said, basically has MS. She can hardly move. She can hardly get out of bed. You know, she's exhausted all the time. There are a number of people I've encountered that have that kind of disability, and certainly victims of trauma and torture might well fall in that category. So I'm sort of exploring this as a possible treatment avenue. That's that. The perhaps more rigorous and more immediately applicable example is what Tony's going to talk about, because the models for continuous improvement of treatment, sharing of best practices and so forth, can be very well facilitated by the tools that he's presenting, and they're much less controversial.
Thank you. Actually, I think that what's interesting, and your question is definitely apt, but you know, in today's marketplace, in today's world, it's not necessarily just about getting the victims online, but also getting those that are in relationship with the victims online, and enabling those that can provide care to provide care and exchange information in relationship with one another so that they can provide better care. And so while it might still be a little ways away before, you know, this individual in Baghdad is able to take advantage of, you know, Second Life therapy, it might be a little ways away. At the same time, there are certainly others that will be traveling to Baghdad to provide care that could be located in any metropolitan area throughout the world that will be able to take advantage of some of the things that David learns and then use those practices when they provide care. Speaking of relationship, that's me and my lovely wife, and I'm from California, and that was down in the Newport Beach area. I'm going to jump in with a big, bold statement that we all hear often. The world is changing. It's become a little bit trite. It's, you know, politicians use it every day. In fact, many politicians use it several hundred times to mean different things. It means something different for everyone. But in fact, the world is changing. The way that we interact with each other, the way that we interact with other cultures, societies, etc., are definitely changing. In fact, things are today changing, according to this company, one light bulb at a time. 1billionbulbs.com actually was founded by a company here in the Boston area. The president of the local company, I think it's called Samaritech, is Brian Heuser, whatever. And essentially, he has this vision. What happened was he saw a Discovery Channel documentary, and he said that if each family switched out one bulb, it would be the equivalent of taking 1 million cars off the road. I went to bed that night intrigued, Heiser said. The next morning, he decided to start 1billionbulbs.com, this company. And it's rather interesting. So far, I think they've changed about 60,000 bulbs, so we'll see if he actually hits his 1 billion mark, but it brings an interesting paradigm to our world. How can we use the internet and the tools that are available via the internet to impact the society in which we live? That's really the question that's being answered here to some degree. Now, is it really as easy to impact the world and essentially take 1 million cars off the road by simply changing one light bulb? Absolutely not. First, you have to get 1 billion people to change one light bulb, which is a little bit more difficult task. Pardon me. The reality is that in today's world, Web 2.0 brings us to a new place. It brings us to a place where the internet is now about you. It's about each one of us as individuals. And we've seen some wonderful things come up over time, such as MySpace, that enable us to create a personal identity online. There are now over 130 million members to MySpace, and it grew at a ridiculous rate. In fact, it's still growing. The technology behind MySpace really isn't all that solid, but people continue to use it. Why? Because people want to tell people about themselves. People want to interact with others. And that's what MySpace started to bring us. The internet has also brought us some other interesting things. It's empowered us to change entertainment. It's empowered us to create entertainment. Years ago, in order to produce a television show or a film, etc., you would have to go out and shoot a pilot. You might spend $40,000, you might spend $400,000, you might spend over $1 million in order to do so. Now, folks are creating entertainment with a simple video camera, putting it online, and being seen all over the world. It's a very interesting dynamic. We also have Wikipedia, redefining credible source. This is popping up as an interesting dynamic, particularly in the education market. Why? Because anybody can go online and edit what is quote-unquote acceptable and real. Wikipedia is quickly becoming one of the most referenced sites as a viable source around the planet, and again, not very old. And then finally, you're all familiar with Digg, and Digg brings us something new, identifying newsworthy. What's really interesting about this is I remember years ago when I was in college, and what was kind of a big topic then was, you know, the right wing versus the left wing, who's controlling the media, who owns what, and who's telling us what we know. And now it's us telling us what we know. We have the opportunity to determine what's newsworthy and take it places. The real nice part about Web 2.0 is there are several tools that come along with it. Really simple syndication, blogs, podcasting, vidcasting, and of course the wiki tools and Friendster. That's what allows us to finally be able to create identity and take it to the world. It also enables us to engage in relationship. The kind of relationships that David was sort of mentioning in terms of online. The problem that we have though now is we're getting to a point where we have literally too much information. If you do a simple search on Google, you're going to get hundreds and hundreds, if not millions, of hits. And how do you cipher through it all? How do you figure out what's important? What's important to you? What's important to you, those that you know? What's kind of tragic to me is that you take something like Rwanda genocide, and there are 1.5 million hits on a Google search. However, most people in the United States have never heard the word Rwanda, and that's tragic to me. The same is true with Congo abuse. 1.3 million hits, 1.3 million pages online, yet most people aren't familiar with what's happening in the Congo. And that, to me, is tragic. The reason that we have this problem is because we truly do have too much information. We're at a point where we have over 100 million websites, over 50 million blogs, podcasting. They're projecting 60 million podcasters by the year 2010, and it's already surpassed the number of radio stations that there are on the planet. Yes?
I think everybody here is sold on this stuff. Can you get to what you're going
to... Absolutely, what I'm actually getting to very quickly. That's why I'm kind of going through
it. Okay.
Thank you.
We are totally on board.
I understand.
So, you mean you don't hate the internet?
How do you impact your world? And that's kind of getting to the discussion point that you'd like me to drive towards, and that's why I was kind of rushing through that. The question is, how do you impact your world, locally, regionally, or globally? And that's kind of really what it's all about. What good is all this stuff if you can't do anything with it? Which brings us to what we call affinity hubs. Now, affinity hubs are a little bit different than social networking. What we do is we connect people, content, and ideas, and they're niche-focused, niche-based. We believe that there's just too much information out there, and if we can create unique environments that are specific to meet needs of unique groups, providing content that's relevant to those individuals, they can get to important information very quickly without having to sort of cipher through a lot of irrelevant material. The Affinity Hub model, the software that we've developed, uses web content management, knowledge management, online collaboration, and social networking. It brings those four pieces of technology into a single solution that's repeatable, deployable, configurable, and scalable. Now, why this is important is because these are the tools that enable you to engage with one another and around ideas or things that you're passionate about. It also enables business to grow business. But what's different is that it starts to level out the playing field. So years ago, we lived under this paradigm. It was sort of a top-down model. Now what we've done is we've moved towards an interactive model. And what was being talked about by Falk and Dye and Ziegler, etc., in the 80s and in the 70s and in the early 90s is finally happening. Anybody on the globe can find a group with which they identify and interact together. One of the questions that was coming up oftentimes when postmodernism in terms of culture was being discussed was whether or not these affinity groups would have conflict and contrast with one another. What's happening now is we're finding that people are able to aggregate based on their common assumptions and common interests, being able to share information and of course, grow their efforts as a community based on that. The question then is this: how do we impact the world? We're still on that. How long do you think it would take for me to go from, how many days, how long would it take for me to go from reaching one person, and I've got a typo there, reaching one person to reaching the entire world if I referred, let's say, three people a day and they referred three and so on and so forth? How long would that take? Any ideas? Months? Anybody else? No? How about 3 weeks? In 3 weeks, under this paradigm, we're actually at a global capacity in 21 days. We've reached everybody on the planet. Now, why can't we do that? Why is it so hard? What's so difficult? We have so much opportunity here in the United States to reach the world, and yet we're really not doing a great job of it. Now, the reality is there's a lot of people that don't have online activity, etc., and we can't really get to them very easily. But this is the potential. It's not probable today, but it is the potential. And this is what we're driving towards. So the issue is, how can we impact global recovery? And what I'm going to talk about now is the impact of Affinity Hub software on this marketplace, because this is an important marketplace. There are people dying, people suffering great trauma, tragedy, etc. I think the question earlier is, how do you define trauma? Trauma is typically the result of torture or the result of some other activity. It's what you suffer psychologically and physically. It's how you suffer. It's the damage that's done, if you will. And there are people all over this world, obviously, suffering great trauma today with very little resources to get help. In fact, many of them are unheard. In fact, many of them die and nobody ever knows. So what we think about is connecting this global community for trauma recovery using this Affinity Hub model that I've sort of described. And that is putting people in a group, in a mass community with sub-communities that have access to content that's relevant, enabling triage, diagnosis, treatment, research, etc., over the web. If we can connect all or a good number of researchers across the web and literally put them in touch with victims of abuse and enable them and empower them to react and respond to the psychological trauma that they're suffering, we could do a lot of good. In addition to that, connecting interagency infrastructures, hospitals, para organizations, donors, and countries around a common content, i.e. sufferers of trauma, bringing them together in this web community in order to solve these real problems, patient communities, families, spouses, etc., being able to connect these people so that they can share their stories, learn from one another. That's the advantage of Web 2.0, is taking these various pieces of what is our culture right now and interlocking them on a specialized piece of content, very focused and able to share information. You know, the same things that you use now, your message boards, your wikis, etc., but using those technologies in specialized environments, discussion and information. And this is kind of what David was talking about, being able to use forums and talk about tactics for survival, and then having that community sort of rank and determine what's valuable to them as content, and then finally social support. But this is what our software does, is it actually enables this kind of community, but it's very focused and specialized. It's not everything for everybody. What it is it's focused on a specific topic, and it brings the people and practices and content together in a specific place so that that content can be consumed, discussed, and collaborated on so that we can take the tools that David's talking about out to the world more effectively. And basically at the end of the day, that is how you empower a local community to reach globally
and aggregate the power that that local community has as it acts globally. So that's what we're doing.
Can you say a little bit more about what, because the web itself has
sure.
tools for doing all these sorts of things and in uncontrolled and unpredictable ways. So,
right.
Granted. So what specifically about 360 Hubs, mm-hmm. What's in it specifically in terms of what it does and why it's particularly well-suited to this, or how are you making it well-suited to this?
Sure. That's a very good question. What we do is we've so far have dealt with the companies, and that's typically where our market has been. David approached me about the opportunity to connect on this particular topic, trauma recovery globally. And what our software enables is the opportunity to aggregate information in one place that is uniquely related to each other and bring those people together. You're right, there are lots of forums out there, there are lots of communities on all kinds of different things. The problem with a lot of those places is that they're sort of disparate. You go here to get this information, you go there to get that information, and you go over here to interact with those people, and how do you find the people that are really on the street, and how do you trust anybody? And what our software does is bring all that into one place, and then using all of these tools, enable that community to interact with one another and identify what is valid information, cut out what is invalid information, and really focus on the topics that matter at hand. And so you're taking disparate environments and aggregating them into a single environment. That's what our software enables. Yep. Either one.
I guess I see how this impacts the world, but I think with the trauma, you want to do more than impact. You want to do good, or at least not do harm. So going back to the original question of licensing, I mean, within a state model, we know that licensing is a means to screen out people who shouldn't be giving medical advice. But within this model, I mean, you know, not to be cynical, but there could be a next bubble for quacks, or people who give bad advice.
Well, this is designed to provide, well, let me give you a business context. I make a good part of my living through designing technology that supports people who do complicated tasks in demanding environments, usually global companies. And it's technology that supports them, enables them to do more work, faster work, better work, communicate more effectively with other people, and so forth. It doesn't determine whether you're qualified to do a job or not. It's really supportive technology. And that's, I think, the concept here. We're not saying that we're going to, you know, empower people who are not qualified to provide services. What we're doing is saying for a population of people that's already doing work, we're going to try to provide them with better tools and more support, more consistent models for managing what they're doing, measuring what they're doing, and so forth, so that they're more effective at it. So that, for example, the 20 Centers for Trauma, Torture and Trauma Survivors around the United States, funded by the Congress, they're, I would say, without offending anybody, I hope, but I would say they're not communicating their best practices among each other as well as they might. That if there was some technology supporting their work, that they could rapidly adopt best practices, implement them, have them supported through technology so they're correctly and consistently delivered, even if their personnel changes and all of that. That's what we're looking for. I mean, if you know, one of my clients is UPS. They have 400,000 people in 206 countries. I'm doing work that directly impacts 90,000 people right here in North America right now with exactly this kind of technology. So part of my thinking is, why not do as well as they do, or better, for people in a therapeutic community? That's the thinking.
I think I would also add to that, that's what's unique about this approach. Using software that's configurable to meet an affinity need, we have the ability to build in identity validation via other systems, etc. We can very easily, in the instance that you're talking about, if we wanted to bring a series of doctors in, let's say, to counsel, etc. online, let's say these represent the doctors, these are individuals in this case, this could be, very literally, a collection of the various certifying boards, etc. And we can take out of their content dynamically their database validation and validate these individuals against that by license number, etc. That's possible. Additionally, we can In the same sense, if we have trusted people on the street that we do know as an organization, depending on where it is in the world, those organizations could be the Red Cross, it could be really anything, United Way, etc., depending on what the issue is. In that case, individuals that are actually on the street that we do know can validate the identity of others that are coming into the community. We have the ability to limit the impact. See, that's one of the issues. This is partly why something like MySpace won't work for this. Obviously, you know, it certainly wasn't created for this, but it won't work because you miss out on that validation. We can keep people out of the community until the identity is validated and then until they've been vetted, and then let them into the community once that's taken place. Yes?
I'm not sure exactly where you are in your process as far as energizing and uniting this community, and I'd love to hear if it's already up and running or at least starting. I'd love to hear about what some of your strategies were as far as bringing together some of the quote unquote experts as well as the users, or if you're not in that stage.
We're at the point where we've talked to enough people in this field. Dr. Malacca wrote a nice note in support of this idea in the book. And certainly, the people in Atlanta I meet with on a regular basis are very excited about it. We're just getting launched. In other words, part of what we're doing is part of what we can do we don't need money for, but part of what we're doing we're going to have to go and get money for. So we're probably looking to write proposals sometime over the next 6 months to various organizations that could fund us to do a pilot project that would allow us to move along as quickly as we'd like.
Is part of your strategy to basically sort of engage people, notable people in the field first, to basically give others who basically want to seek out some comfort from this, give them a reason to go?
A reason to go?
A reason. Well, I mean, you have to. I mean, obviously, you want to engage. Medical experts.
Well, we're here because there are a lot of smart people here. I know that. I've been here enough to know that there are a lot of smart people in this room, well-connected people of this university. There are people at the medical school. There are people at the law school. Well-known people like Dr. Malacca is an expert in the field. Yeah, I want to talk to as many people as I can. I'm talking to someone who might be a senator from Georgia in a couple of years. I mean, yeah, I'm talking to people who are trying to get interest and trying to get people to buy into this approach and see if we can get funding for it.
Wait, I'm sorry, that's not what my question was.
That's
okay, thank you for that. No, my question is, as far as, it's always a very tricky thing, how do you actually start from zero to build a community? And some people start by having, basically having content there by a lot of these people that you're talking about there as a reason for others to join up and participate and start contributing their own content.
Well, it's like the example I used in Second Life. The communities are already there. They just don't have the technical infrastructure to support what you're doing. I mean, if you went to Atlanta, Georgia, there are 10,000 refugees from Bosnia. There are 40,000 refugees from Vietnam. There are communities of refugees. There are 60,000, I think, something like that or more, in Atlanta who are, in this torture, potentially in the torture and trauma survivors program. So supporting those populations, the populations that already work for them, the clinical populations there. I mean, some of the tools we're talking about are available for free or at very low prices. I'm going to talk to Tony about making a good deal for these people. And hopefully we can get them to use a lot of this without a huge investment. But obviously, one of my goals, quite frankly, is to have successful demonstrations or pilot projects so that we can go to Bill and Melinda Gates and say, well, here's the data. We can prove that what we're doing makes a difference. Wouldn't you like to be able to scale that so it was occurring on a much larger scale, and you could demonstrate through real data collection that what you're doing was making a huge difference? No one else is doing it. Help us out. I mean, I'd like to be able to do that.
I think the idea is partly why we're where we're at in terms of our relationship is that from a solution perspective, we have a configurable solution that can meet the need. I think for David right now, it's partly identifying what is that practice to bring it to market, what exactly is the need, and who are the relevant players. And that's probably why he's doing a lot of, vision casting right now, as you would probably put it, and I would agree. I think that to a large part, what David's doing right now is sort of refining what that vision is and identifying the people in the marketplace that he needs to get on board. with this. What the thing for us is this solution for us. We've got it working in business in other environments that have nothing on earth to do with this. But this provides an opportunity for us to make a global impact with the software that we've developed, and that's why I'm personally excited about it.
A couple of thoughts, and I don't want to sound like a naysayer, just something to think about. It's not necessarily that it's negative, but one, as you pointed out, you're not creating new people who are unlicensed or whatever. You just creating access to them in a sense of finding them or whatever. But as you do it, you also, in the eyes of a lot of people, providing some kind of a validation that there is, even though you're not really doing it, for people, they think that way, that since they are there and they found through you, they have some kind of your approval. The other thing that made me think mostly during your presentation is one of the biggest problems in society is, or one of the things that society is lacking the most is a human warmth. We all live in a world where we're lacking human connection. And as more and more consulent services would be available on Second Life and other web services, it would provide those service to people, you know, with a mass and physical disabilities that can get out. It would also provide, it would enable, sort of like enabling an alcoholic, it would enable people who don't get out to never get out at all. It would be just one more way for them to seek and get what they want and need without ever getting out to a real world and interacting with real humans.
I'll address the first part and then maybe you can address the second part. The first part that you asked about the validation and how this kind of environment can actually empower and seem to present a false validation for people that really are not certified. That's what you were suggesting, correct? Right. Okay. I guess I would suggest that the internet's already doing that right now. Just because somebody goes and puts a website up calling themselves a counselor certainly doesn't make them certified. Yet people browse Google, Yahoo, etc., and find counselors online every day that are, in some cases, not certified. So the internet's already doing that.
I quickly point out, if you go to the state of Georgia's licensing board website, you can within 5 minutes verify whether someone has the correct credentials to practice in Georgia or not.
People have an assumption that if it's not that person but somebody else, then that somebody else did that job for them. I'm not saying it's correct.
Right. No, I understand.
That's a human tendency.
Sure. It provides a transfer of credibility because of the source that's allowing it. I understand. But the issue is that's partly what we help to filter is by taking advantage of some of these other sources like the certifying organizations, etc., and building that into this community as a component. Then what that allows us to do is help to provide a filter against those that are already pitching a shingle on the internet and calling themselves qualified. We can put in a layer of qualification that doesn't currently exist in the marketplace in the general internet. As far as the second point that you brought up, I lost it.
Well, I would say, I think it was my turn anyway.
It was your turn.
It wasn't yours.
So I was
my opinion about that is that I believe very strongly in using technology to supplement human interactions, but I believe in human interactions. You know, I don't have a practice in Second Life. I meet with people in my office, or in some places I meet them, you know, at their office. In fact, if they're executives and I'm working with them, sometimes it works that way. And that's certainly the best way, because so much of what you get from human interaction is nonverbal. Someone can be saying something to me and I can hear them saying something else. You know how that works. So what can I say? I mean, people use the telephone, people write letters, they communicate in lots of ways. Technology's here to stay, the internet's here to stay. I hope it's not going to replace human interaction. I don't think it will.
I'd like to augment that a little bit. And I won't go into all the details, but I have been given permission to talk about this today. My wife was a victim of sexual abuse as a child, and really, really nasty stuff. For her, she became highly dissociative. And she would clinically be defined as having been multiple, with multiple personalities, etc., clinically, at one time. Well, when she was struggling, what she would do is she would recede. She would become recluse, exactly like you described. She would disappear for sometimes days, sometimes a week at a time, you know, covers over the head, hiding in the room, that sort of thing. During those times, what she ended up putting in place was a series of individuals that she felt safe connecting with. And this was not a physical touch thing. At that time, it was, you know, on the phone, see people that she could call. And I think that there are a lot of people that are still, one, too embarrassed to talk about some of the things that they've experienced. And so what the web will enable them is an opportunity to meet others, candidly, that have suffered some of the same things that they have that they're not quite ready to share with somebody that they can see, feel, and touch. Secondly, it can provide them an online support system that they can interact with when they're not feeling comfortable enough to interact with a live body. I think it opens up the opportunity. And then finally, I think that process can help bring them into real authentic relationship with others, you know, clinically or otherwise, where they can discuss some of these issues. So it may be an undiscovered first step towards healing, possibly. And that's where David was suggesting it hasn't been feathered out yet. I mean, we don't know. The research hasn't been done. But that's what you're suggesting, right?
Absolutely.
I'm not saying that, you know, it doesn't provide positive things that are not available otherwise. Sort of, I'm not saying, you know, quit the internet, just like, you know, don't quit the phone. It, you know, phone is a help. It's not replacement.
Right.
But, you know, again, give you an example, just like you use example of your wife. I have a neighbor who successfully started quite a few high-tech companies around, some of which you probably know. And in a conversation with him last night, it turned out that he hasn't seen people for months. And I said, who was the last person you spoke with? She says, you. And I said, you haven't spoken to me for months. He said, I haven't spoken with anybody else.
I've got a couple developers under that same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, so he's interacting with the world. He's developing companies without ever interacting with humans.
Right.
Well, you know, I used to have a job where they called me the human interface. They're the most hardcore technical people you can imagine. You know, we're back in that room in the back, and I was the guy who could talk to them and then translate what they said to other people. So I don't know whether we're going to be able to change that. I don't know.
I want to add something to that, too, and I think you're bringing up a very good point. And you know, addiction is a problem in our society, regardless of what the addiction is, too. And for some people, it's the internet. And I think that the way that you get to those people is going to be the way that they're going to accept you, which is going to be via the internet. And I think that that's going to be the first place that they're going to receive a challenge that maybe their habits, their life habits, are not healthy.
Just have a couple points. One, and there, I researched, I'm wondering if you're aware of this other online community called GroupLoop.org, and it was GroupLoop.
I'm not familiar with it, no.
And it's organized by the Wellness Foundation, and it's for teens who are survivors or experiencing or currently struggling with cancer.
Mm.
And it's very much like the model you're describing, where they have licensed therapists. There's an application process. They have to go through this application process in order to get in. And there are different levels of privacy, so someone who's not a part of the community can observe
right.
interaction, but then there's a whole other level of privacy where only approved members can talk to each other, and it just seemed like a very useful support group. And then secondly, there are some research studies that have been done about the benefits of online communities for folks going through medical problems or other experiences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd love to know about that.
I'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much. I'd like that very much. Yeah.
Talking to the first thing, that's a big advantage. Is, you know, for a lot of people, that security of the user-to-user relationship is important, and that's one thing that our software allows you to do out of the box. For example, we're currently doing some implementations for churches to manage their small group or home Bible study systems that they have in their churches. And content can become very sensitive in some of those arenas. So what we had to do was build that kind of security into the software, where somebody that places a blog can identify exactly which user groups, i.e. my friends, my small group members, or the church at large, has, or and then the public, has access to what it is that I'm writing. And that can be applied at the podcast, the forum post, the whole nine yards. And so I think that it's very interesting that you bring that up, because that is an interesting or important component of protecting the sensitivity of the content, particularly in this topic.
I had a question, just technically, how this fits into something like Second Life or a wiki, particularly not in at any level, but particularly I'm interested in all of the universe of agents around your chart have to put up policies that can then be consumed by the members of the group or the people who are looking to look at the group. So this is a problem we're struggling with, is how what's the standard, what's the infrastructure by which one of these agents or one of these services puts up policy information for people to consume?
Honestly, that's driven by security, and it's going to be different for every organization. So for example, what our company would do in your case is we would sit down with you, determine what your security needs are, who should have the right to create content versus who should only have the right to read content, and what levels of interaction those individuals should
have. I'm asking technically in the Web 2.0 world.
Right.
Where
how is that created?
How do you translate this into the Web 2.0 concept?
Our software uses things like Wiki, which is what you asked, forums, blogs, news feeds, I mean the whole bit. So I guess if you're asking me how do we create policies, we have Wiki tools for creating policies. We can apply security to the owners of the community, or we could allow security open to the users of the security, depending on your niche needs. So we use those tools to accomplish, unless I'm completely missing your question.
So you can do this in Second Life, for example?
We wouldn't actually do it within Second Life. Second Life is sort of its own entity. Wiki is a tool.
Right.
So
you do this with any wiki or just a particular wiki?
We do it with our own wiki that we've written. So we've got over 50 different modules that we've written for all of these different, you know, content sharing type and creation type components. So we've written a wiki tool, we've written a forum tool, we've written all of these different modules, and then what we do is we configure those modules to meet your need. Now, if Second Life approached us and said, "Hey, can we apply this to Second Life?" I'm sure I could find a way. But
there are also a lot of things you can do in Second Life that the creators didn't intend. I mean, for example, one of the things that you have control over scripting. You can use the tools that are in Second Life to create various kinds of constraints and structures and forms and things like that, but those need to be defined by the user community to a large extent with the business rules or whatever, and then you can help them.
Right. I was asking the question, like, I'm involved with federated identity management groups, and these people in general, and many people here know about this, I'm sure, are trying to sort of reach out to whatever the tools people are using, and I'm trying to figure out where policies fit into that world or do that.
You know, I'd be more than happy to show you how it can be done. So. Yes?
So just looking at this chart, I think your plan makes perfect sense for the bottom three circles. Because this is really good for building a post-treatment community and building a very vital community in that sense. But I wonder if there's more of a need for a government role in the top two circles there, both in the sense of credentialing providers, making sure that the treatment being offered is correct, coordinating efforts between different agencies, like making sure the CDC is talking to Office of Rural Health Policy or whatnot, using the Health and Human Services Department to ensure there's proper coordination between agencies. And I guess third, also ensuring that the data being shared in these communities is being shared in a private way, and that when you are sharing personal medical data, which I'm sure will happen if you're sharing best practices, or maybe not, but that there's some way to ensure that it's not falling into the wrong hands, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, those are all definitely concerns that would have to be ferreted out when doing the discovery on how to configure this particular community. Certainly, there are ways to implement the security to accomplish the protection that you're talking about. The continuum that you sort of have is no security, everything open, absolute security, nothing really all that usable. And so you're having to find that place where It's still usable, but people are protected, and that's kind of what we go through. But again, there's nothing keeping from one of the keeping one of those circles from being a government agency as an oversight committee, etc. I mean, that's possible and plausible with the technology.
I can't turn my head. Is there somebody?
Yes, go ahead.
Beyond the technology, how are you going to, what are your tactics, what are your thoughts about how you're going to get people actually to participate in this?
Well, so far, everybody that I've asked that's involved with this activity has said they want to participate. So I haven't asked that many people, but I've sort of asked key people who are currently in positions of responsibility. You know, the director of the CTTS in Atlanta, for example. Some of the people at the CDC and other people in communities that are involved with handling these issues right now, especially for torture survivors. And so the method, I suppose, is to form a team and start developing implementation strategies for one or more centers, and then also to try to get to enlist the support of other private as well as federal funding sources. So, I mean, as an example, I have a relationship with UPS. UPS has a foundation that gives away millions of dollars for many things because I have access to some of those people. I'm hoping to get some private funding.
A follow up?
Pardon me?
May I ask a follow up?
Of course.
Do you know Clippinger? Okay. John Clippinger, whose new book, A Crowd of One, is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is sort of about what I'm about to ask you, which a little bit anyway. He's associated with the center. He writes about what he calls social physics, which I think is a really spiffy term.
Sounds spiffy. I don't know what it means.
I will put it way worse than he does. But it's are there predictable factors, sort of levers that you can use in order to help shape a community and to keep it running healthily and not have it fail? You know, so you look at communities that have worked and ones that haven't.
I actually have had a good deal of experience creating communities of practice.
So my question is, what
self-sustaining communities of practice.
Have you thought about the policies, the tools that are needed, and the implications of those for how the communities are going to form, what effect they're going to have, what questions about encouraging, allowing, not allowing, anonymity, pseudonymity, I mean, the whole range
of... Have I thought through all of that? Absolutely not.
Do you have thoughts about it?
I have thoughts about it.
Okay.
The closest example, I mean, Nick can help with this, right? Nick and I have known each other for 8 years. You know these ELC groups that I've got? I formed, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, communities of practice in terms of using technology for learning in Atlanta and Boston, for example, and they were self-sustaining. Essentially, it began with the concept that the people with responsibility have global responsibility for technology that is used to educate and train and support people in their companies globally. You want to talk more than anything else with other people who have that same job. The person at UPS who has 400,000 people, he's got to make sure they learn everything they're supposed to learn. You know, there are consultants who'll talk to them. There are people who want to sell them enterprise software licenses. But the person Nick wants to talk to most, I would say, is the person who has a similar job in a similar organization. So sharing that and facilitating the sharing of that information is vitally important. Then it's also been my role in this particular organization to bring in people who are industry-leading experts, thought leaders, and so forth, to address those people. I thought they'd take that over and tell me who they wanted to have come in, but I've done it, and they wanted it that way. And then I've brought in university communities. For example, the MIT people who were working on this UPS project, I arranged that. I brought MIT that project because I wanted them to be involved. So I'm sort of creating this sort of a stone soup type thing where everybody who participates in this community brings something to it. Some of the members pay a membership fee. Some of the people who come contribute their expertise, but they get back knowledge from the community. So I know I've built communities like that successfully for the last 5 years around a particular area of expertise. I think I know how to do that now for other groups, for other kinds of things. Have I written a manual about how to do that? No, but I think I know pretty well how it happens. So I'm looking at it, could I do it better? I'm sure. Does that help? I don't know if that answers.
it's a process answer rather than, you know, this is how we're going to, I have full confidence that that's how you're going to do it. If you, as you get further along in figuring out and the particularities of issues like anonymity and the policies for control that the software allows you and which particular types of software features are going to be more important. How important is IM going to be? How important is email going to be? Will a listserv do what a group might do? That something that Second Life might do. I mean, all these. I'd be really interested in seeing what
process. Experience. People, it's going to evolve.
Yeah. And as it goes along, I think it'll be fascinating to see what works.
Right.
Yeah, it really will be because different people are going to take advantage of different things and use them in ways that you wouldn't even understand. We've got a client right now that is trying to connect all the Catholics in the world in a transactional donation for small little charities all over the planet sort of way, kind of a MySpace for Catholics is how she's intending to use this. And you know, what I've told her is you're going to start this and where it ends up 3 weeks after it's launched is going to be so innately different than what you started with. Your community is going to identify and define what your business model really is. In her case, it's a nonprofit. But you know, so I think that you're square on that. The information that comes out of this will be wholly different than after the process than where it is today, because the community, what's been shown now is that the communities really do determine how the information is used, how it should be used, how it shouldn't be used. That all comes into play sort of once it's up.
Oh, these aren't online communities. These are real communities, physical. People who meet physically.
Okay. Well, the question actually still applies. Sure. So there, you succeeded in bringing together a variety of people to share their ideas, best practices. Do you have any sort of systematic way to sort of, you know, use that group, you know, the benefit of that group to sort of,
I'll tell you where we are with that. Okay. Where we are with that is we are just adopting his software. So that we can make sure we capture that information and make it available. So that, for example, the group that meets in Boston and the group that meet in Atlanta, well, they're two different groups, and yet there's an awful lot of information and sharing that can occur. In some cases, we've had a couple of meetings up in Maine where we've gotten people from both groups to go up there in Maine to Maine for 3 days and have a meeting. But the concept behind using his software is to provide, you know, iPods and iPod podcasts of the meetings, or records of the copies of documents, and you know, create a repository of information so that everybody so it's not ephemeral, you know, that's like you folks do right here. That's so well.
I think the last thing I would add to that, and then we've been asked to wrap up, is that what we do is we take with our software, we take all the content that's created by the users, whether they're blogs, podcasts, forum posts. Even comments, etc., via commenting, and we can apply tags to all of those. And then using that tagging system, we can interrelate that content to itself so that all of the content within the environment is wholly dynamic and relatable. And that kind of starts to get to the answer that you're asking about, is how do you classify it, how do you harvest it, and how do you repurpose it? And that's what that sort of system that we're developing, or have developed, continue to develop, allows, is it actually enables us to take that one comment on that blog post over here and relate it to somebody else's forum post when they were completely disparate instances. But because of the content and the nature of it, we can relate those together. And then the community can sort of ferret out what's more important than what, etc. And so what you're really doing is you're actually creating the marketplace of ideas, as we've all come to know. You're actually creating it online and enabling it to be repurposed and reused, et cetera, and searched. So that's all I have. Do you have anything else?
No. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
You.